nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for allowing me not to have to travel to Australia this time. So, although I'd like to visit there, it would have been very hectic. So let me share some of the excitement that I see in NanoHub with you. And what I have on the screen here is actually a log of a week of activities within NanoHub, some week in February of this year. So what you see here is sort of green spikes, people registering on the site. They turn into yellow dots that are people that are running simulations without installing any software. And then you see a third category of symbols. Those are red dots that are people that don't even have to register or sign up. It's just a completely open site that look at seminars and tutorials and lectures. And we have effectively 12,000 registered users per year that run simulations, so they consume real resources, and over 230,000 users they look at seminars, tutorials, and lectures, etc. So when I asked for this animation to be made out, kind of would have thought people kind of sleep, at least overnight a little bit, but what you really see here, it's a 24/7 operation of a cyber infrastructure that really operates globally and has impact. And if you look at a sort of an integrated way, basically wherever there's lights on at night, we have NanoHub users in the world, meaning wherever there's infrastructure with internet, we also have NanoHub users, which is a kind of a cool thing. So you see sort of burst-like behavior, meaning some of the dots become really large. That means there's a lot of people at that particular time slot coming to NanoHub. So there's burst-like activities. There's systemic activities. And what I'd like to convince you today is that there's actually real scientific knowledge transfer happening. So really people learning and having a transfer from one research group of results into a new classroom usage, into research results, etc. And I'm sort of subtitling my presentation these days in terms of myth busting. I'm going to talk about all these things that we were told over the years we can't really do. So here I'm showing you the usage growth chart for the simulation users over the years, going back to February of 2000. And you see a strong knee right there at about 2005, and that's when we turned the site from a sort of web form-based internet computing into interactive applications that are really engineering-like applications where you can really ask what-if questions and really explore data. And we have started at about 2004, we started to put up lectures and seminars into NanoHub, and we've seen a tremendous growth in there. We're over 230,000 users now, and you see a little dip there in 2008. That's probably the stock market crash. So we'll see what else we can highlight in some of these items. So this is an overview of NanoHub, and obviously this is not just my doing. There's really a lot of people involved. And on the bottom left, you see our NanoHub and HubZero team. That's about 20 professionals that are really involved with this. And on the top right, you see sort of a representative picture of my research group that is about now 25 to 30 people. And that is really sort of an example or pictures of the work I had done at Texas Instruments, then at NASA, JPL, and now at Purdue. But I have to add a third component to that, which is now there's over 1,000 content contributors on NanoHub now that really make all of this possible. Such that you attract over 230,000 people coming to the site. So my thanks go to them as well for me to be able to show their impact and maybe to give you some ideas about cyber infrastructure as well. So before I take you into the future of cyber infrastructure or NanoHub today, I'm going to take you to the year 1965. It's a personally very important year to me. I was born. But actually more important is there's somebody sketched a something into his notebook. And the person sketched an economic law in there, and that's the number of components per integrated circuit versus the relative manufacturing cost. And you really see on a log-log scale, you see decaying lines, which really mean we can put more components into a circuit for a lowered a manufacturing cost. And today we call this Moore's Law. And Gordon Moore was a founder of Intel. So this is the original sketch out of his notebook. You might be more familiar with Moore's Law in this form, where you plot the number of transistors on a chip as a function of years, and basically you have an exponential growth. And today we're at about 2 billion transistors on a chip. That's quite a big number. That's, to put that in perspective, that's about a third of the world's population working cohesively together in doing something constructive, which is probably not likely going to happen in the real world. But this is an engineering marvel, right? It's 2 billion things coordinated together. Another way to look at Moore's Law is looking at the downscaling of transistors, where we now have devices that are of the order of tens of nanometer. So these might be forms you are familiar with in Moore's Law, but you might also know, if you have some electrical engineering background, that there's really these two ways of scaling are enabled by two pieces of software. The one is Berkeley SPICE, which is really a circuit simulation tool set. And that really allows the co-integration or the coordination of systems of systems and of circuits to be designed. And then there is Stanford Supreme, which is a process modeling tool set that allows you to model the growth and deposition of materials at these kind of materials length scales. So maybe you knew that, but what you probably don't know is where these two pieces of software come from. So let me highlight that. So Berkeley SPICE comes out of Berkeley, so says the name. But what you probably don't know, it started as a class project. It was developed as a teaching tool, and it was one of the first open source codes, and the dissemination venue was like this. Peterson, the professor, carried it around on tapes and delivered it to various audiences. This is pre-internet, right? So he carried tapes and said, okay, here, take the codes and break it and let me know when it's broken so we can fix it. So there was never an assumption of perfectness or quality control of an industrial product. And the code took off in terms of students using it in industry and academia. And now it's the standard circuit simulation tool. And it's been now reintegrated anew from scratch in various forms. But really, this started as a teaching tool, which is quite a big impact if you think about it. Stanford had the idea that we are about ready now to do process simulation in a more integrated sense. And they created a research tool that was geared towards the research in semiconductor device processing. And it was disseminated by community workshops, and students took it along to industry and academia, similar to the SPICE code. But these two codes, in a sense of process simulation and circuit integration, today delivered the capability to have a total world industry of about $280 billion of the semiconductor industry. Without these two concepts of process simulation and circuit simulation, that would not have happened. So the idea now is, can you do something similar? Can you create codes and research? Can you create codes for teaching that work at the nanoscale and maybe help integration of many things together? And really, can you have, out of these nano initiatives that we have in the U.S., that we have worldwide, can we have outcome out of this cornucopia of research and really affect the real world in a variety of fields like electronics, materials, photonics, mechanics, bio, and medicine? So that's sort of the dream of the nanotechnology era. But what we hope to do with NanoHub and NCN is really enable the usage of the results that come out of this research endeavor. So you might think of nanotechnology, maybe people in bunny suits, maybe working on chips. You might think of expensive facilities like we have one here. To do, it's the Berg Nanotechnology Center. So those are experimental facilities, experimental efforts. But you might also think of nano models, like these carbon nanotubes that I'm showing you here. These carbon nanotube visualization here of these three different tubes is actually an interactive visualization anybody in the world can now do on NanoHub. You might think of quantum dots, which are artificial atoms, where you can really create your own characteristic sp and d orbitals in man-made artificial atoms. And everybody can now do visualizations like these in NanoHub and understand the absorption of light, say, in these type of quantum dots. So those are computational models, right? And they run on computational engines, like supercomputers we have here at Purdue, small computers, big computers. We actually have about 40,000 cores that are running here at Purdue at a variety of supercomputers. And these codes are operated by computational scientists, like me, that work on computers and build these models. So, what you may not realize that there's usually pretty big barriers between the experimental world and this computational world. And the real idea now is, can you bridge the gaps? Can you bridge these barriers such that experimentalists might actually have access to and utilize these type of models? And that would imply that us, the geeks on the computing side, actually put the stuff out there to make it available. Maybe we even gather around and actually have many of us do that. And if there's lots of supply, maybe there's also lots of utilization on the experimental side. But imagine that there's maybe more barriers to overcome. For example, you might want to use that in education. And maybe you could even have impact on industry with this kind of architecture. And the goal is really, of course, to have this run in an easy-to-use fashion without any installation and to have that run in any browser. So that's sort of an idea of a portal. And you can replace nanotechnology or nanoscience with any science that uses some sort of computing or some sort of data usage in this. There's nothing specific in that in terms of nano. So it's, in a sense, it's a common dream. It's a dream of creating a portal that really embraces all of these users and these developers, education and in research. And you kind of have to ask yourself, why is this so hard? I mean, there is very few portals that really come close to this dream. And I think one core component of this problem is that it's this process here, right? It's the putting stuff into the web. The problem is fundamentally that we don't do that. In general, computational scientists don't do this because most research codes are written by one user for one user. And they can be barely operated by one student, and usually even the professor can't quite operate it him or herself. So you might have codes that might have input decks that look like this. So this is a input deck I would consider pretty structured, nice, but it's complete gobbledygook to you as an audience, as a non-expert. Even if you're outside of my group, this input deck would make no sense to you. But so I would call that user hostile, right? But you want to get to user friendly, and maybe the same input deck that you have seen you can represent in a form like this, so suddenly it turns into an interactive application that can actually operate the modeling and the simulation of a quantum dot. So if you have something like this where you don't have to read a 200-page manual and take a course for a month, you might actually operate this tool pretty easily, and maybe experimentalists might use it. Okay. So you want to get to user-friendly, and we have a technology that we developed to develop these interfaces, and I'll talk a little bit about it. We call that technology Rapture. We'll get to it. But you have to have one more element. Not only does it have to be user-friendly, it also has to be developer-friendly, meaning it has to be easy for the scientists to actually create these input decks and then put them on the web. And for that, we have now a technology that we call HubZero that allows us to put these tools on the web really fast, really easily, and then make it accessible
for the rest of the world without any installation. So these are the three key elements here. They need to be user-friendly. You need to have people that are willing to put it in there, so they need to be developer-friendly. And you have to have an infrastructure that makes it accessible. So this dream is actually common to many, and it's been kind of hard to achieve. And while it's hard, has been hard to achieve, in that process, there's a lot of myths that have emerged around these three elements. And I want to highlight some of these myths. For example, user-friendly. I have been told by review panels that you cannot use research codes for education. It was inconceivable that you could use straight research codes for education. There's also the perception out there that you have to rewrite your code to do that you have to write your own code to do research, meaning you can't really reuse somebody else's code, otherwise you can't do really research, or it can't be good research. And certainly experimentalists will never touch this. So these are sort of myths on the usage side, on the usage mode side. But even on the developer side, there's myths. Some of these myths are that building user interfaces is too difficult, too expensive. You must rewrite your code for web deployment. And there's no incentive to do so. So why should I share my code? I can write papers myself. Thank you very much. And certainly there was no cloud infrastructure, an end-to-end infrastructure that can host these tools. So these are myths that we faced and we've been told in panel reviews, etc. And I want to kind of debunk some of these myths today in my presentation. So let's go to the core process of a science gateway. And in many ways, many proposals are reading alike. So you might have a researcher with some cool tool, and you might have a supervisor, a group supervisor that says, we want to put that on the web. And maybe that person develops a proposal and gets funding to engage a web developer. That web developer typically takes the code and basically rewrites it in Java, PHP, Perl, and slowly in a phase of 2 to 3 years, you have a facsimile of the original tool showing up on the web. Now, 2 or 3 years, which researchers do you know that are going to sit around for 2 or 3 years and does not evolve his or her tool? So these tools keep evolving in parallel next to the web form. In fact, this researcher starts to get aggravated. And these tools will never be validated, right? The researcher has been disowned what is on the right side, and they keep developing versions on the left. And what you end up having on the web will be completely outdated by the time it actually goes and sees the light of day. And in the process, it typically is about $500,000 per tool, and these $500,000 have not sponsored any new research. So that gets this researcher really aggravated. Now, to make a point, if you publish or create 175 tools in 4 years, that would take you about $88 million. So certainly I can assure you that the US NSF will not spend $88 million on these applications. Right? So it's completely out of the question, and it shows you how non-scalable this process is. So in that process, however, that is the typical one, you scale back your expectations. So what does that mean? Well, these myths emerge. These are not real research codes. These are toy applications. There's no deep research possible in this form, and maybe you can use it for education. Yeah, fine, but maybe. So this nano-op process is quite different in that it goes against this bad reputation that many of these portals have built up. So in the nano-op process, we actually did deploy 175 tools in 4 years without $88 million. We basically eliminated the middleman. So we enable researchers to deploy their own codes. They retain their intellectual ownership. They don't need to rewrite it. And they get less aggravated because it takes them about a week or two to put the first version of the tool up. And we provide them with a whole software development ecosystem and this Rapture toolkit. So this ecosystem is sort of depicted here, where a researcher gets what we call a workspace. That's basically a Unix workstation running inside a browser. We give them software repositories. We give them access to grid computing. We give them staging and testing infrastructure, and then we publish the tool in the same framework within NanoHub. And all of that is sort of embedded in the NanoHub software stack, where we have projects, teams, repositories, wiki nodes, user support, question and answer, ticket system. The whole thing is integrated into one ecosystem. So I want to show you now that this actually works with a couple of numbers. So what you see here on this chart are the blue bars are the number of tools that are being put on NanoHub, and they're nicely growing. There's actually now over 260 tools on NanoHub. The green line is the number of developers that in general are not paid by us, by the NCN. And that number is now over 300 developers. So now what you see upcoming next is that these developers actually create new versions of these tools. So these versions now exceed actually here on the chart 1,200. We're over 1,400 tool versions now, meaning these researchers are indeed connected, stay connected to their tools, and these tools keep evolving on the web. And remember this what I mentioned with SPICE, that there was no assumption of the perfect tool. You keep evolving it. We have a framework where people actually do that now. So let me tell you a little bit more details of this cyber infrastructure of how do we put tools on the web. So we might have a tool developer. They can have code in C or Fortran or MATLAB. And we have an end user that wants to see this ultimately on the web. In between, we have a process where a tool developer registers a tool. They create their code into the workspace. Then they install it. If you have a user interface on your code today and it runs in Linux, you basically don't have to do anything but recompile the code in our infrastructure. Then they have to approve it, and then our system engineer will look at it and install it, and then ultimately it will get published. And it's all driven by almost like a web publishing system. So no more emails flying back and forth, but really it's almost like inverse shopping compared to Amazon. So instead of putting in your credit cards and buying something, you actually do the other way around. You interact with the system, and then it's all very clear on where we stand. Like, we are waiting for you to approve this tool, or we are working on your tool. Please hold on. We will contact you. So here in this chart, what I want to show you, what I think is pretty impressive in a sense that you see each dot here around, surrounding the NanoHub site is a tool, and there's various stages that these tools are in as color-coded on the left. And now I'm going to show you an evolution of NanoHub tools over time as they come to life. And basically, whenever the tool wiggles a little bit, there's activity by the developers. And whenever there's a line shooting across from NanoHub to these tools, that's some interaction of the NanoHub infrastructure or a person of NanoHub with the tool. And so you sort of see activities going on, and you see the tool number growing, and you see how they go from registered, created, uploaded, installed, approved, and published. You can see also that some older tools get updated and then republished. So it's a continual work, and the interesting thing is that all of this is managed by one person, one software engineer in our group that is managing the staging of the tools and then the final publishing of the tools. So the rest is really managed by the tool developers themselves. So you just saw it getting really quiet around January and Christmas time, and then the semester starts again and the activity bursts, right? So I was kind of waiting for that. So basically, this is an infrastructure that allows us to manage many software projects and publish them. So I mentioned that there is lots of new tool versions. So we had 190 tools plus about 1,000 version updates in the last 5 years. So those are plotted here with a number of tools growing very nicely. But with the number of updates that we receive, if you had just, say, downloaded the code onto your local machine, and it would be, after 1 year, about a third of these tools would be out of date. About 2 years later, two-thirds of these tools would be outdated. That gives you some idea, right? If, in a sense, you have a life cycle management problem of software, and some of the tool dissemination, scientific tool dissemination work like this. I eventually put a tarball on the web, and it's up to the user to download the latest tarball and then reinstall it on a machine, which often is painful. So you have to manage all of that. But in a sense, NanoHub users always get access to the latest version of the NanoHub tools. So they don't have to worry about the lifecycle management of that. And we really take away a lot of the workload that scientists would normally have otherwise. So if you go to NanoHub, it looks like sort of a normal website. And if you launch a tool on NanoHub, it talks to our middleware that runs on a cluster here at Purdue. And in that cluster, we run a virtual machine. And in that virtual machine, we run an instance that executes a piece of Unix code in X11. We then pipe the VNC session to the user. And the user is fully interacting with that virtual machine remotely and maybe does visualization, etc., simple visualizations. Maybe the runs happen right on the tool cluster if it's a thin code. But if it's a heavy code, the jobs can be launched on a grid that's connected to our cluster. And really the interesting thing is this is all behind the firewall already of being logged in. It's all behind the Unix identification. So we execute codes for our users on their behalf on grid infrastructures. They don't have to have grid certificates, etc. If you do simple visualization, they can run in the virtual machine. If you have sophisticated visualizations, pardon me, they get run on a visualization cluster, and the visualization cluster is then piping the visuals to the user. So effectively, the user is visualizing remote sessions through VNC into remote machines without having to install anything really on their local machine. So that's incredibly powerful. It also works well under low bandwidth conditions. So that's all fine and dandy. So basically, if you have a piece of code that has a Linux-based graphical user interface, it can run very easily in this infrastructure and be ported to it. But most science codes actually don't have a graphical user interface. So how do you get a graphical user interface into a system like this? So for that, we've built an infrastructure we call Rapture, which is an open source piece of software. You take your simulation code and wrap it with XML, and you can create user interfaces that look like this carbon nanotube user tool. And the interesting aspect of that is that this tool was written by an undergrad in my group in a week. And he didn't even know really what carbon nanotubes are. So it's a great teaching tool to teach undergrads to write tools. And they can do it pretty easily. And the cool thing is they don't have to touch the science code. The science code could be written in anything that's a modern language, like scripting languages, compiled languages, you name it. We basically have interfaces or APIs of Rapture into these languages. So we can build tools. The interesting aspect is now that people work together on tools. So what you see on the screen here are dots, and each dot is a tool. And these tools are linked by white lines, which are the people that are working on these tools. The color coding on these dots is the origin of the tool. Yellow is not Purdue, orange is Illinois, purple is Northwestern. The white tools, interestingly, are from the outside. Those are tools we as the operators of NanoHub have nothing to do with. So even there's social networks forming. And you can really see how developers are working together on multiple tools. You can also now measure the impact. If I now look at the for each of these tools that are now on this chart, I'm showing a dot for each developer. So each developer is a dot, and I can put them on a coordinate system by the number of users they have served on the vertical axis and the number of collaborators that they have had. So if you look at the sort of the left, you can have a impact with a few collaborators. But if you have a lot of collaborators, like of the order of 20 or 30, you can actually impact 1,000 or 10,000 people very easily. So you can start to measure the impact of collaborative people on a broader user base. Furthermore, we've started to put together an incentive system for people to contribute. So here's my colleague, Dragica Vasileska. She's actually not formally part of the NCN or NanoUp. She's a professor at Arizona State University. She was one of the early contributors to NanoHub. She has 17 tools on the site. In all, she's served over 11,000 users with simulations. And any contributor really gets an impact chart as shown here inside the cornucopia, where we show the monthly users and also the integral number of users. And she is advanced in her career. We now write books together on how to use these tools on computational electronics. An example of a younger person is a former postdoc in my group. In his tenure here, he created some 8 tools that served some 6,000 users. And then he went away, became a faculty member at Southern Illinois University. And what I'm showing you on the top right are the number of users that are at that university. So basically, before the red line, before Sheikh arrived there, there was virtually no usage of NanoHub there. With his arrival, the usage on the log scale spikes up continuously. So he was integrating NanoHub into his curriculum. He was creating new courses with NanoHub, and he used it for his research. And interestingly enough, after 2 years, he was promoted with tenure. And in a very nice letter that I received from his department head, he attributed his presence and his activity of NanoHub to be a strategic component in the advancement of Sheikh's career. So I think that's quite an interesting impact statement in terms of creating incentives for people to participate. We also now have NanoHub lectures on iTunes U. We're actually one of the partners on iTunes U, in pretty good company with NPR and other universities, high-level universities. So in that sense, NanoHub is considered almost a university in that sense, in terms of iTunes U. We also start to put our contents and animations into Wikipedia. So with that, the idea was to make Wikipedia a better resource and then link back to detailed resources and animations and simulations back to NanoHub. So here's an example of a fullerene model. And I thought it would be cool to translate these pages, but within a month or so, we had other languages, like here Punjabi and Italian and here German. Obviously, the Germans really know what a buckyball looks like. So we started to drive after we did this. We drive about 4,000 to 5,000 visits monthly now that come back from Wikipedia back into NanoHub. So overall, I would argue now that we are developer-friendly, that building user interfaces does not have to be difficult. You don't have to rewrite your code at all to deploy it on the web. And we have now incentive systems that might make it worthwhile for you to deploy codes. So really, this myth is busted by real numbers, right? We have over 260 interactive tools with over 300 developers that are mostly volunteers. So these sets of myths are busted. Now let's look at some others. So I'm going back to this global chart of activities. You see the activity basically 24/7 on the globe. I think I don't need to make an explanation that indeed we are accessible, and it is an end-to-end science cloud, and it is possible, and it's operated out of a university. So we don't have to worry about this myth anymore. let's pick up this other myth, set of myths that deal with the users. So let's pick them up one by one, where we had heard from our panels, our peers, that you cannot use research codes for education, that you must rewrite your own code to do research, and that experimentalists shall never touch this. So let's dive in a little bit. So what we have here is, in a sense, a matrix, right? So I'm shamelessly abusing the movie. But what we have to do is now we have to stare into this matrix and actually figure out what people are doing. And we have a way of doing this by behavior analysis. We actually look at coordinated analysis by users. And what I'm showing you here is a user in a function of days is maybe using a green tool as shown on the top left, then no activity one day, and then in two subsequent days he uses this orange tool on the right, and then the green tool again. So as a function of days, we attribute activities of a particular user, and then we scroll through a whole bunch of users over a year. So I'm starting to look at the NanoHub matrix here, where I'm looking back in the history of 2010, and it looks like the matrix that's zooming by as if there's no coordination. But once you start staring at it, you see some streaks, some patterns, some chunks, big chunks. So you start to wonder, what's going on here? So we developed some algorithms that actually plow through this matrix and basically perform user-to-user correlation. And we find significant patterns. We find patterns of single usage. Come basically once throughout the year for 1 week and do something. Come throughout a whole semester intensively, use one tool. In the row C, come and use 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different tools throughout a whole semester. And then we have other patterns, and on the bottom, we have completely uncorrelated users. So we can identify actually concretely in these data that I'm showing here, concrete classes of sophomores in materials engineering, mechanical engineering, seniors in electrical engineering, freshmen in chemistry, sophomores in materials engineering. So these are bona fide courses where we actually know who the instructors were, but we knew that they were teaching, but we found these patterns through our algorithm. We also have ways to identify, and I'll show that in a little while, how we do that, experimental researchers and computational researchers that have actually published with NanoHub. And we have ways, the rest of the users we call self-study users, because we actually don't know exactly what they're doing. So the interesting thing is we can now calculate the number of users and in their behavior, categorize them in the classes. And while I said in A, that was one concrete class, we have actually 96 classes like that in this one academic year. And in all, we had in the academic year 09-10, we had some 116 courses at 97 institutions that utilized NanoHub in the systemic way for education. In all, over the last 10 years, it has been 14,000 students in 760 courses at over 189 institutions that fall into the systemic use of research codes that are virtually coming out of research in systemic classroom use. So this myth that you can't use research codes for education is busted. It is possible, it is widely possible, and it's starting to be viral that people really use it, where we don't have to go out and promote it and twist people's arms. If it works, people actually come and use it. The other cool thing we can do is now we can measure the time between this tool is published with a digital object identifier, DOI, the time between its publication and its first use in a systemic classroom pattern. And you might want to measure or compare that time against the typical time for a textbook update. There's studies, and one of them shows it's about 3.8 years. That study also says to have a new concept in a textbook, it takes two editions, which sort of jives with the impression it takes about 5 to 6 years to develop a new textbook. So let me compare the first time adoption of these tools against this textbook on a really weird scale. going from years to months to weeks. And let me show you the histogram of tool adoption on NanoHub. We actually have some 19 tools or so that have been published on NanoHub and used within a week in a classroom. Some 22 tools within a month, and actually the median time is less than 6 months for adoption. Now you might say, hey, wait a minute, Klimek here. That must be self-adoption, right? Those are people like you that know the tool is being published and you publish it for your own class and then use it, or other people like you. True. We actually have two distributions in here. We have the self-adopters, meaning adaptation of the tools at the same institution from where they come from. So indeed, you could say, well, these are the tools that were created specifically for this, for a particular class. But then there's a second curve in there, the blue one, that is really indicating adoption at a different institution. So other faculty members find these tools and integrate them into their own curriculum without having designed that tool themselves. So that's kind of interesting that really there's two models of adoption in there versus the technology push and the technology pull, in a sense. All right. So that's kind of cool. Now let's look at the users that are more the research users, and what can we identify there? Is there research output? Is there a capability that we enable for these users that behave completely uncorrelated? So remember, the myth is that you can't use somebody else's code for research, right? So let's look at that. How do we measure research? Well, we look at research publication. We now have over 850 papers that cite NanoHub in the scientific literature. We can categorize them by nanotechnology publications, by cyber infrastructure publications. There's now even publications that deal with education on how you can use NanoHub to educate folks. The lines, so each dot is a paper. The lines between the dots are common authors. So you can see that these papers are sort of forming social networks. And the core with the yellow line, those are, that's the NanoHub core. Looks pretty compact. Although really there's actually 77% of the authors are outside of the inner core. Meaning really we reach new users, new authors that we enable to use our computational research. So the myth that you can't use somebody else's research code is busted. We can also now go into these publications and categorize them by content. The nano ones, we can look at, do they contain experimental data? Or are there even experimentalists on there? And there's a significant number of these papers that have the experimental data and experimentalists on there. You can even see social networks forming here that are here really around experimentalists that are sitting outside the core, and of course on the inside we always work with experimentalists to validate and verify our tools. So the myth that experimentalists will never touch this is busted, and they will use computational work. And without showing that in detail, I can just state here that 9% of the papers are co-authored by industry authors. So there's industry impact as well. All right. Then, of course, once I showed these social network charts, my panel said, well, okay, fine, you can do research, but it can't be good research. So what do? You break down that myth as well, right? So you study what are the secondary citations on these publications that we have. So what I'm showing you here is sort of an example on how you compute the H-index. What you see here is maybe an example of a faculty member 3 years into their PhD with this lower line here. So that person has 6 papers that have been cited 6 or more times. Here's a person well established in their career, member of Academy of Engineering, 37 papers cited more than 37 times. So 3 years ago, NanoHub had 575 papers, 3,200 secondary citations. That amounts to an H-index of 27. That was being 7 years in business, right? So that accelerates pretty well. Actually, today now we have over 850 papers, 7,500 secondary citations. The H-index that corresponds to these publications is 41. So we enable research that is also then heavily cited. You can argue whether H-index is the best way to measure that, but at least it's a common practice to measure it that way. So, but still many people think, well, deep research is still not possible because deep research means many CPUs. So, let's see whether we can have some many CPUs running on NanoHub. So here's a tool that's very dear to my heart because that's really my core expertise to build a tool set we call NeMo. It's been 18 years in the development at Texas Instruments, at NASA JPL, and at Purdue. We model quantum dots like this and nanowires, ultra-thin body transistors, graphene, carbon nanotubes. That code set, one of the versions of this code, Omen, actually scales to the petascale. So if you're in parallel computing, you're supposed to say ooh-ah, because what you see here is really on the bottom, we have code that scales up to over 220,000 cores, virtually perfectly scaling on a sustained level of 1.44 petaflops. And to put that in perspective, running 1 hour on that machine corresponds to about 25 years running in the serial code. So that code won an honorable mention at supercomputing last year. Unfortunately, the Japanese had bigger computers in that year, so we couldn't win it. The same code base of NeMo also is being used for single atom transistors and examining Ohm's law at the atomic scale. This is actually a collaboration I have with researchers at the University of New South Wales and also at the University of Melbourne. And that's being used, that NeMo code is being used for these publications that are pretty high level. So what's even more exciting is that this code base is also being used in 8 tools on NanoHub, and it has served some 10,000 users that have run some 166,000 simulations. So this is something I could never have done at NASA JPL. That was the reason why I left Southern California, come back to the Midwest, to create an infrastructure that allows me as a researcher to deploy my codes globally. That is what I wanted to do. So, to me, that's impactful. But there's many other codes that are on NanoHub that are also computationally intensive. We have codes like Quantum Espresso, Siesta, Games, Abinet, Sequest. So if you're a computational scientist in the materials, these things might mean something to you. And the bottom line is 10,000 users have utilized this over the last few years. So computationally intensive work is possible. The question now is, how do people use it? So, let me back up. So this myth that you have to, that you can't do computationally expensive work on NanoHub is also busted, right? So this works in NanoHub quite well. So now, let me look at the actual consumption of resources by NanoHub users. And I'm looking at the classroom use first. So on the right, you see the chart of patterns of classroom usages. So here's classroom A, B, C, D, and E, and F. And I can now chart here on the left, I can chart where each dot is one user on the axis of number of simulations that person has run versus the CPU time they have consumed. And you can tell by the color coding with these classes, different classes have different patterns of CPU consumption and simulu time they run. And if I just put everybody on anybody that has used it in a classroom like that, these are the faint white dots, you basically get this oval here that describes sort of generally the classroom behavior. Now I want to contrast that with the researcher behavior, where we have information now on the computational researchers, the experimental researchers, and the self-study users. So again, the computational researchers here in turquoise, they run pretty heavily, large number of CPUs. The experimentalists use a little bit less, and this what we call self-study users run significantly less, basically two orders of magnitude less CPU time and number of runs. If I actually put all of these next to each other, you can compare them, but I can also put them on the same chart, where now what I'm showing you here is The long ovals on the top right are the computation, the bona fide researchers that have published. And down here, these four ovals are people that are in classrooms or who we call self-study users. So the reason to call them self-study users seems to be actually bona fide now. They behave like classroom users at their normal intensity of running. And they have about research users, maybe 200 runs, 8 hours of CPU time on average. The top might be 10,000 runs and 10,000 hours. On the education side, 20 runs, 5 minutes, and the top maybe 400 runs at 20 hours of CPU. That gives you a feeling of different requirements of what people are using in the site. I'm going to ramp down my presentation now on, I think, what's a key punchline. That is, we have now a way also to look at users, to look at their behavior, and their behavior reflects back on the tools. So I'd shown you this chart, this raindrop chart of user behavior in classrooms, right? So that can now reflect back on the tool. And I can rank a particular tool in terms of intensity of use in classrooms, so in teaching, from, say, 0 to 1. On some arbitrary scale from 0 to 1, I can come up with a ranking. The dot size is just a number of users. And I can also now, by plowing through the literature, identify users that have published with tools, and I can rank them on an orthogonal axis. I can say, well, on a chart from 0 to 1, rank these tools by intensity of use in research. And there were some times when our review panels asked us, well, you have 140 tools on NanoHub. Tell us how many are educational and how many were research tools. And at that time, I already felt, well, that's kind of a hard thing to do. I don't think there's a very good way to do that. But we gave them a number that was our best guess on the assumption that these axes are orthogonal. But if we actually put all on the 235 tools on the same chart, you see that many tools actually bridge research and education. And in fact, we kind of knew that. Suprem, I started my presentation with, was a research tool. But I can attest to you that as when I was a graduate student studying semiconductor processing, I used Suprem as a teaching tool. I learned about semiconductor processing. I also mentioned in the beginning of my presentation that SPICE was a teaching tool, and of course we all know it has become a research and a production tool. So now the question is, how do these tools evolve? And what we have now here is a way to visualize that evolution. I'm going to start out by 10 years going back and put a tool as they appear, either on this axis here, on teaching or on research or wherever they might be, and then I have them evolve over time. So there's a few tools going back to 2001, but what you overall see is sort of tools trickling in from the research side generally and coming down. But there's some tools that also had popped in over here on the teaching side and crawl back up. Like you see this blue dot here. So the point now, we have sort of a way to even look at the time evolution of these tools. And I think this is a powerful message to send that really you shouldn't think about separating true innovative research from true innovative education. And that those two are closely coupled. And that's when you have a powerful education and can teach students the novel ways of going about doing business and teach them about innovation. So in about 2007, we realized NanoHub infrastructure is really something else. We spun out something we call Hub Zero, which is an empty hub. We ramped up the processes, and by now we have some over 40 hubs that are running. To give you an idea, they also have users as well. So NanoHub is by far still the largest. But in all, if you look at number of users or visitors, there's a significant number of individuals that are really utilizing the various Hub Zero sites. So this is something kind of cool that came out of this whole NanoHub effort, a whole infrastructure for building hubs. And with that, I'd like to conclude my presentation in reminding you that I think I can now show that there is scientific knowledge transfer within NanoHub. And really the goal is to make research useful for others, and there's many different others. We are clearly accessible. I believe we are user-friendly with 12,000 simulation users. They perform research, they participate in education. I think they accelerate innovation in education. We're developer-friendly because we don't have to twist people's arm and spend a lot of money on tool deployment. And that's being done with an infrastructure we call Hub Zero and Rapture. And let me just ask you out there, if you entertain me for two more minutes, I'm going to tell you where I think we take it next, if that's okay. So we start out from NanoHub, where we imagine we want to do simulation tools for researchers, experimentalists in a cloud for education. I think in a way we've achieved that dream. And what we want to do is now imagine more where we do this now also with experimental data. We might have to change the way we deal with some of the technology, but really what I'm after is to be able to read papers, say on an iPad, in a digital paper. I want to click on a graph and I want to come back to the original data that generated this graph and maybe compare my own to it and really make nano-engineering reproducible. And the idea is to do that in many nano areas. Really enable personalized learning and become part of the day-to-day workflow. And as we do that, what I'm hoping for is sustainability, to really form a professional society that in 10 years down the line, we have people that are working in Nano that help to sustain NanoHub as their venue of interaction, of data housing, modeling and simulation. So with that, I thank you for your attention. Thank you very much.
So the question I had is, I've seen some of the stuff on NanoHub obviously over the years, but the bit I didn't appreciate was the level of almost meta-analysis you've done on the use of the system so that you've just presented. So did you have separate grants to fund that, or was it just sort of things that grew up along the way?
No, I developed, pushed for this type of analysis throughout the years, and many people didn't quite appreciate it or understand why it was needed, but I felt we wanted to deliver an infrastructure, and I always felt that if you want to show that you have an infrastructure, you got to measure how many cars are driving on that road. And we were not an experiment into cyber infrastructure. Our goal was to have a fully operational infrastructure, and I think assessment is a critical element in that, and we can maybe have a discussion on that later. In a sense, I had sort of scribbled on the screen here success criteria. So we have developed some criteria that we suggest all other hubs or portals might consider seriously before they get started. And assessment is one of the critical elements that are needed to be discussed.
Yeah, so it sort of was done along the way. That's very impressive.
Thank you.
Please thank Gary again for it.
Thank you.